Okay, so I think we can start. Okay, good. Okay, so we can start tonight's talk. And tonight I'm going to talk about commitment and perseverance on the Buddhist path. And I think for many people, those of you who have been Buddhist for a long time, you will know that this is perhaps one of the most difficult things on the Buddhist path, is to really commit yourself and persevere in the practice. It's actually one of those things that, remember the idea of Buddhism. Buddhism is like this thing which accumulates over time. And the more you keep on practicing, the more you keep going on this path, the more greater are actually the benefits of this practice. If you do a little bit, you get a little bit of benefit. But if you keep on doing this for like 20 years, then after a while it really starts to make a big difference. So this idea of committing oneself properly to the maximum of one's ability, and then to persevere in that practice, keep on going and going and going. This is one of the most important things in the Buddhist teaching. Probably anything in life, right? If you want to be successful in anything, you have to commit and you have to persevere. And Buddhist teaching is no different from anything else. But what is so strange about this is how difficult it actually is to really commit and to persevere. How hard it is to remind yourself of what you're supposed to do moment from moment, right? One moment after the other one, day to day. It's so easy to be led astray, to go on a sidetrack, do all kind of other things. Like mobile phones, right? Big sidetrack in life, mobile phones. By the way, I just should tell you that if you ever hear a mobile phone ringing during meditation, number one, it's unavoidable, right? There's always going to be a mobile phone going off during meditation. Doesn't matter how many signs you have, doesn't matter how big the signs are, doesn't matter how many times Drew says, please turn off your mobile phones, there's still going to be mobile phones ringing during meditation practice. So just accept it. It's not going to be different from that. And what the right attitude, I reckon, to have if that happens is to think, whoa, I feel so much compassion for that person whose mobile phone is ringing. It's so embarrassing, right? You're sitting there. Everybody around is looking, almost glaring at you. You can feel the stare. Oh, this is terrible. So please have compassion if somebody's mobile phone rings. And it's very beautiful. If you have compassion, the atmosphere in the room stays the same. And you don't, and nothing happens in a meditation practice. You don't break the meditation. You just continue on, flow on very beautifully. That is the right attitude to have. So that is part of this idea of commitment, right? It's actually very difficult to do this. So many other things in Buddhist life are easy. Sometimes I will talk about some of those easy things first of all, before I move on to explain how we are able to really commit and persevere in this practice. What can we do to ensure that commitment actually is maxed out, if you like, at all times? Some of the things that we often think are difficult in Buddhism is like the intellectual side of Buddhism, right? We think that understanding all this word of the Buddha, dependent, arising, the Four Noble Truths, or whatever, all of these things, they seem so complicated and difficult. Surely Buddhism is like an intellectual teaching, and we should probably sit around contemplating Buddhism for the rest of our lives. That'd probably be very profitable. And this is a... one of those ideas that people tend to have is that, you know, thinking about this is very powerful and useful. And of course, there is some truth to that. Some reflection and contemplation is always necessary. But there's a tendency to take that too far. And I think the reason is because it's very kind of addictive to think about things. Our minds are already restless, right? They're always moving around already. So all we do is just kind of take that movement onto the Buddhist sphere instead, and we keep on moving there. So we're kind of addicted to thinking already. So just move that thinking into that direction. But please don't be too trapped by this intellectual curiosity and always roaming about, because in the end, it's not going to take you very far. I always think about one of the very funny things about Buddhist translation. I translate quite a bit of suttas and that sort of thing. Suttas is the word of the Buddha, and I translate it from the original Pali language. Pali language closely related to Sanskrit. This is the language that the suttas are written down in. And one of these very, 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 very well-known word from the suttas is a word called jhana. Many of you have heard of jhana, some of you probably not. Jhana is a state of very deep meditation, right? Extremely deep. So deep that there's no thinking going on. There's complete stillness and absolute bliss in the mind. Very, very profound and exceptionally beautiful. And when you get there, you're already very, very close to awakening itself. And then the early translators who translated these words, right? This wasn't in the early days, so we have to excuse them for their kind of the lack of understanding. They didn't really know anything about Buddhism. They had all these strange terms they had to render into English. They didn't really know what they were doing. And one of the famous translations for jhana, which is this very profound non-thinking state, was musing. Musing, oh, I wonder, musing. Kind of you take out your pipe sitting in front of the fireplace. Ah, dependent origination, avijja paccaya sankhara, delusion leads to sankharas, right? And this, you can see here, has some of the most profound things and has all to do with Buddhist meditation practice. It's distorted into something which is more like an intellectual exercise rather than a really deep and profound state of meditation practice. So this is a danger, and I think that the reason again is because our minds tend to be inherently restless. I think a lot of Buddhist history can be explained by the restlessness of the human mind. One of the great, beautiful things that the Buddha says in the suttas, the Buddha talks about the handful of leaves that it picks up in the forest. This is from a place called the Gosinga Wood. This is where this particular episode takes place. And it picks up a handful of leaves. And it says to the monks, well, what is more, the handful of leaves I have here, or the leaves on the forest floor? Right? It's a no-brainer, of course. And the monks dutifully say, oh yeah, yeah, the leaves in your hands are few, the ones in the forest floor are many. Right? That's how it goes in the suttas. And the Buddha says, in the same way, just as the handful of leaves that I have here are few compared to the leaves in the forest, in exactly the same way, what I have taught you is little compared to what I actually know. Right? What I have taught you is little. Why is that so little? Because the only things that I have taught you are those things that are conducive to the practice that lead to the goal of happiness and away from suffering, eventually take you to full awakening. That is what I have taught you. I have not taught you all the extraneous stuff, all the stuff which is philosophical, right? Which is like metaphysics, ideas about the world, which may be true, but they're not really related to this. And yet, as human beings, we love philosophy. We love to sit back, light our little pipe and philosophize about the about the world, right? We love this. And this is kind of the human state of mind. It's how we act as human beings. And of course, from that restlessness of the mind, from this philosophizing, the Buddha says, don't philosophize. These are the practical teaching. Forget about all the other stuff. And what do the monks do as soon as the Buddha has passed away? They start philosophizing, right? The first thing that's, okay, the Buddha has passed away. Now, the problem is with the Buddha's teaching, right? Okay, he taught all of these things. It's all very nice, all very good, and it's all very practical, but it's not really complete, right? There's little holes here and there. He didn't kind of divide everything up into absolute final terms. He didn't kind of bring it down to the tiniest amount of time. How many bits can you divide a second into? Either is it billion or a trillion bits in 1 second? Like how many bits are there in there? Right? How many different mind states are possible in this world? How do they all relate to each other? The Buddha kind of said lots of nice stuff, but it didn't lay everything down, right? So now it is our job to fill in all the gaps, fill in all the holes in the teachings. And that is exactly what happened after the Buddha passed away. And from that, the result of all this philosophizing, trying to fill in all the holes, trying to fill in all the gaps, the result of that is what is now known as the Abhidhamma Pitaka. Abhidhamma is sometimes translated as the higher teachings, but they're not the higher teachings. They're just philosophy. It is monks nuns, perhaps even some lay people were involved, mostly the monks, I think, because they were the ones who kind of were dealing with these kind of things, thinking about things, working it all out, right? And eventually ending up with the Abhidhamma Pitaka. This is Buddhist philosophy for you. Buddhism is not a philosophy here. It's not meant to be a philosophy. It's not meant to describe the state of the world in all its aspects and all its kind of divisions. The Buddhism is meant to be a practical path for how to make your life better. There is a reason why the Buddha did not philosophize. Because the Buddha realized that philosophizing is very addictive. Philosophizing is going to take you down the wrong track. It's going to keep on philosophizing forever. There's no end to that. And Buddhist history shows us that there is no end to philosophizing. Because then the Theravadan sect, the Theravadins, they are the ones who went to Sri Lanka, right? Around the time of Ashoka, they went to Sri Lanka. And Buddhism has been in Sri Lanka ever since. It is the most ancient Buddhist culture still alive in the world today, is what you find in Sri Lanka. It's a very wonderful thing to go to Sri Lanka and see some of those amazing ancient Buddhist monuments they have there, going back over 2,000 years. I've been there, and it's very fascinating and very beautiful there. But so one branch of Buddhism went to Sri Lanka, Theravadins. Another one went to the north of India, Sarvastivadins. It means all exists, the all exists school, right? And then they started to argue with each other, because my Abhidhamma is this, but your Abhidhamma is different. Your Abhidhamma must be wrong, right? Mine is always right, yours is always wrong. That's how we tend to think as human beings. And then they argue with each other. And I think this is precisely the problem that the Buddha could foresee. Once you start philosophizing, there is no end to it. So remember, as far as I'm concerned, Buddhism is not a philosophy. Right? People say it's a philosophy. Well, Buddhism might be a philosophy, but the original teaching of the Buddha were not a philosophy. Buddhism is what we have now. The original teaching of the Buddha are slightly different from what we have now. They were not a philosophy. They were a practical path. If Buddhism is anything, I would say it's a psychology. Right? It's about finding happiness in the world. Moving away from suffering towards happiness. How to use our mind in a skillful way to move in that direction. If anything, it's a psychology, and certainly not a philosophy. So remember that. Don't fall into that trap. This does not mean that we should never study anything or never listen to any talks or never try to understand the word of the Buddha. But the things that you need to understand, the things that will take you towards awakening, towards greater happiness, away from suffering, they are actually very simple things. Right? Simple things. Be kind. Be compassionate. Look at the world in such a way that you don't feel too much too angry. You don't feel jealous. You don't have these negative states of mind arising in you. That's difficult enough already, but it's relatively straightforward and simple. That is what we need to focus on, not so much the philosophy here. So this is like one sidetrack, right? One way of going wrong, and that is the wrong kind of commitment and perseverance, if you like. There's another one, and this sidetrack is a sidetrack that you find more often in traditional Buddhist societies, and this is a sidetrack where you do endless amount of rituals, right? Everything becomes a ritual, and you can see that in most Buddhist societies that have been there for a long time, that this is very common. And again, you can see why that happens, because rituals are relatively easy to do compared to trying to change your attitude and change the person you are. Often that is much more challenging here. So again, that's another sidetrack, too many rituals. I think, actually, sometimes I think in the West we don't do enough rituals, right? You get Westerners coming in here, they think, oh, this is really scary. This Buddha statue, boy, that is frightening. Such a large image, right? It's kind of overpowering. And then you're supposed to bow. This bowing business is pretty frightening. I remember when I first had to bow, I thought it was pretty scary myself. But remember that rituals are part of life, right? We all do rituals. Everybody has to do rituals. Every time you shake somebody's hand, for goodness sake, you're doing a ritual. Every time you say some polite phrases to somebody you don't know, it's really a ritual. Every time you set your table, right, fork on the left side, knife on the right side, spoon facing this way, glass over here, it's like a ritual, right? Everything has its place. So much of life is ritualized anyway. It's not really that we're doing anything else in Buddhism. It's just slightly different rituals. And some of the rituals that we do in Buddhism are actually very meaningful and very beautiful and very powerful once you get into them in the right way. Like, for example, coming in here and bowing down. What is that all about? And once you get into the idea of bowing to something that you feel is larger than yourself, right? Some values that you are aspiring for in life that maybe some other people have, but you don't. We assume the Buddha had these qualities, right? So when you bow down to this piece of metal at the back here, you are bowing down to something which represents those qualities that the Buddha had according to the suttas. That's what you're bowing down to. There's something very beautiful and powerful about that. Check it out. Don't be too frightened about these things, right? Oh no, too scary. Please don't be scared. And once you get into that, it also tends to lower your ego a little bit, lower your sense of self. And there's something very nice about that, taking oneself so seriously, right? Having your ego always boosted, but actually lowering it down a little bit. It's beautiful. It kind of feels like you're being a bit humble. And there's something that opens up your mind when you're more humble. You're more receptive. You're more listening. You're not so full of yourself. And what a wonderful thing that is. You start to realize the ego tends to be a burden in life. The less ego you have, the more relaxed you are, the less vulnerable you are for other people challenging you, right? The ego can always be challenged. Less ego means less challenge. And you actually feel so much better as a consequence. So check it out. Some of these simple rituals, not too much, but some of them are very powerful and beautiful. But again, as I'm saying, if that's all you do, it is too much, right? You can't just do rituals. Again, it's the wrong kind of commitment. Rituals should have a meaning. They should work for you. And when they work for you in the right way, they have a meaning. They're very beautiful. That is the second way. A third way, I think, in which we sometimes go wrong when we try to persevere and commit, is that we just do meditation practice. This is kind of the thing you often find perhaps in the West, right? People go to one meditation retreat after the other, 10 days, 10 days, 10 days, 1 month, right? And sometimes that's all they do. Their whole life becomes kind of focused on meditation practice. That's all they ever do. And they become like meditation junkies. I'm not sure if that is a technical word, but that's kind of a word that is used. We become meditation junkie. All you ever do is meditation. And the danger with that is that in Buddhism, meditation is only one aspect of a much broader path. The meditation actually fits in there. It has a certain purpose. But only when it fits in with these other aspects does it actually really work. You can meditate for your rest of your life, right? 10-day retreat here, 10-day retreat there, and never get anywhere because you don't understand the position, the place of meditation on the Buddhist path. It's only when it fits in with all the other factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, kindness, compassion, understanding, right outlook, right, how to look at the world in the right way, right thinking, all of these kind of things. That's when meditation starts to work. If you don't understand that, then this meditation is going to stagnate. You're not going to go anywhere. It doesn't matter how much you persevere, right, because you're persevering in the wrong way. So again, there needs to be a degree of intelligence to that perseverance, a degree of insight, a degree of wisdom, and then things start to come together very beautifully. Right? So remember that. It's actually far more important to be a kind, wholesome person who thinks about other people in a nice and beautiful way, who has a sense of compassion and care for the world, right? This is more important because it's more basic. And when that falls into place and you are able to change your attitudes and become that kind of person, then guess what? meditation just happens, right? You sit back, you just chill, you just, whoa, so beautiful to be here tonight with all these wonderful people around me. And you really feel that inside of you, right? And then when you feel that, you relax so nicely. And when you relax so nicely, meditation just takes place. Meditation is so easy. All you have to do is to be quiet. All you have to do is relax and watch your breath. And yet for some reason it doesn't work. And the reason why it doesn't work is because all the other factors of the path aren't into place. It's not because you are so stupid you can't watch your breath, right? Nobody is that stupid. Everybody can watch the breath. If you can breathe, for goodness sake, you can watch the breath. Can you breathe? Anyone here can't breathe? Everybody can breathe, right? So if you can breathe, you are in business. You're in the right place. You can do this. So, again, this is another thing that we have to be careful of, just becoming complete meditation junkies. Sometimes they call that spiritual bypassing, when you don't really want to deal with your problems, right? Actually, I have a bit of anger. Maybe I should try to overcome that. That's exactly right. Try to overcome that. If you can overcome your anger, overcome your negativities, become a more positive and wholesome person, bang, meditation is going to work. It's going to be so powerful. No spiritual bypassing. No closing your eyes to your own defilements and problems, right? Please don't close your eyes to those things. Be honest about yourself. We need to see ourselves for who we are. Only when you see yourself for who you are, can you actually deal with your problems. You've got to be brutally honest with yourself. Sometimes that's painful, but in the end, it's going to be incredibly useful if you can do that. So, how do we then commit and persevere in the right way, in a good way, in a way which actually leads to something positive in life? And to be able to understand this, what the Buddha gives some very beautiful teachings on this, and I'm not going to go into all the details, because if you go into all the details, oh, it will be a very long talk. And you will complain next week to Ajahn Brahm, say, oh, this monk, please send him back to Bodhinyana Monastery. He talks too much. Go back. So I'm not going to do that, because it should be simple anyway, right? Basic, simple teachings. And one of the things the Buddha says is that if you want to reach awakening, I'm putting the bar really, really high here, right? But we know awakening is something good. It's the supreme happiness. So we all want to be more happy, so we want to at least move towards that awakening experience. So if you want to get to awakening, what do we have to do? And the Buddha teaches us this beautiful causal sequence, one thing leading to the next one, all the way up to awakening. This is one of the hallmarks of the Buddhist teachings. Everything is conditioned, everything is caused, everything relies on something else for its existence, right? Everything has some cause, some reason why it exists. And the reason why that is the case, and this brings us to one of the most profound aspects and most typical aspects, hallmark aspects of the Buddhist teachings, the idea of non-self. The idea that there is nothing there, which is always there, which stands fast, that you can hold on to. This is the real me. The Buddha says that is a delusion. And because that is if that is the case, and of course I invite you to investigate that for yourself, of course, but if that is the case, it means that everything in the world is conditioned by other things. Nothing stands alone. And because of that, everything in Buddhism has these sequences, one thing leading to the next one, stage after stage after stage. So awakening has a cause. It doesn't happen as a miracle. It doesn't happen as an act of will. It happens when you put the causes into place. So what is the cause of awakening here? This is already really exciting, right? Really exciting stuff. The cause for awakening. What can be more exciting than that? It's really, really exciting. The more you understand the Buddhist teachings, you think, whoa, this is, because this is what it's all about as far as Buddhism is concerned. What is the cause for awakening? The answer is deep meditation. When you go into a very deep state of meditation, samadhi is really the word that is used in the suttas. That is the cause for awakening. This, you may think that this is obvious, perhaps. Or maybe you think, really? Okay, I didn't know anything about this. Okay, thank you for telling me, but whatever. Or something like that. But this actually is really, really important and really fundamental according to the Buddhist teachings. Most people don't realize that. People can have been Buddhist for decades and not really understand that. And sometimes they think, oh, all you have to do is kind of sit back and watch things passing away, arising and passing away, and that will lead to awakening. That may be a help, but really it is deep meditation that is the answer, the cause for awakening to happen. See this throughout the suttas. Then the Buddha takes it back, right? Stage by stage. What is the cause for deep meditation? What is the cause for that? I'm not going to go through every step now. Back and back and back. 10 steps until it comes to the very first step. What is the very first step that leads to awakening ultimately? Isn't this exciting? Are you excited now? Right? This is the beginning. This is what leads to everything else. This is really, really cool. So the very first step is, the Buddha says, to hang out with the superior people. Right? Or the good people is another translation. Or the noble ones is another translation. That is the very first step. Noble person number one in this world is not Ajahn Brahm. Right? It is the Buddha. The Buddha is number one. Right? So what the Buddha is, because the Buddha is number one Kalyanamitta. He is like the eye of the world. He's the first one who attains awakening. The first one who sees reality as it actually is. And because of that, he is the eye of the world. He tells you the truth as he has realized it. And that enables you to practice the same path. If somebody does not awaken to the truth, how is they? That means we're all in darkness, right? So one person is the forerunner. Everybody else comes afterwards. And that person happens to be the Buddha. So he is this, not the only one, there may be others as well. But he is the first and foremost of these people. Right? At the very beginning of path. So you want to hang out with the Buddha. You may think, oh, are you kidding? What do you mean, hang out with the Buddha? He lived 2,500 years ago. How can you hang out with the Buddha? And I will tell you how you can hang out with the Buddha. It's not as hard as you may think. Because the thing about the Buddha is that he bequeathed this mass of discourses that he taught 2,500 years ago. They exist in kind of, 25 volumes or whatever in the present day. Very, very beautiful teachings. They are available to the present day. And a lot of the things that I say when I give teachings here at Dhammaloka Center are precisely from the Buddha himself. I've already quoted the Buddha a number of times already, right? And these are the teachings that are so inspiring in my opinion. So that is where you go. When you read those teachings, you are literally in the presence of the Buddha. Right? The Buddha is talking to you. Why is the Buddha talking to you? Because when the Buddha, and I don't know, this is the kind of thing which I like to think about the Buddha, and I've talked about these things before. But remember that when the Buddha taught these things 2,500 years ago, he was saying, I'm setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. The wheel of the Dhamma is this teaching that rolls on in the world, and it rolls on from century to century, from millennia, from millennium to millennium, right? Keeps on rolling until eventually one day it runs out of momentum and it falls over. But he said that. He knew that these teachings were going to keep going for a long, long time in the future. And because he knew that, he expressed these teachings in a way that are not limited to one particular culture, limited to one particular time, but they are so broad that when you read them in the present day, you can feel like this makes just as much sense to me today as it probably did to those ancient Indians 2,500 years ago, right? That is the feeling you get when you read those things. And not only do you have that feeling, but you know that the Buddha was thinking of you. Right? He was thinking about the future. He says this wheel of the Dhamma will keep on rolling down the centuries. Quite literally. He was thinking of each one of us. Maybe he knew that there would be an assembly of people coming together in a northern suburb of Perth, in the faraway continent of Australia, in the middle of the desert somewhere, right? And they would be sitting there listening to the Dhamma. Imagine. You probably wouldn't have thought exactly that. But something like that, right? That there would be people listening to these things. So the Buddha was thinking of us, each one of us, when he gave those teachings 2,500 years ago. This kind of makes your hair stand on end, right? If you have hair, that is. But it's very kind of tangible. So this is one of the ways of actually recollecting the Buddha, understanding what he is about. And then when you read the suttas, then when you read his word, and you know that he was thinking of you in particular, whoa, it really comes to life, right? I have to tell you, when you read the suttas, when you read the word of the Buddha, don't just read page after page as if you're reading a novel, right? Please don't do that. Because the suttas have a very different structure. You can read whatever you like in there, whatever you enjoy, that is what you should read. So if something makes absolutely no sense of you, or you're falling asleep or whatever, then just turn a few pages and move on to the next one. This is not meant to start on page 1 and end on page 5,550, right? It's quite long, the sutta. No, you read whatever you enjoy. And when you enjoy it, that is when you're able to take it on board and becomes powerful for you. I don't know, Ajahn Brahm may have told you this here before. Ajahn Brahm always tells a story about this Tibetan teacher, a lama or something. And he says how you're supposed to teach the Dhamma, right? And the way you're supposed to teach the Dhamma, Ajahn Brahm is really a master of this. Teach the Dhamma in this way. First of all, you make everybody laugh, right? You can see what I mean. Ajahn Brahm is a master of this. You make everybody laugh. And then when their mouth is agape, you chuck in the pill of wisdom. Right? It's kind of nice, isn't it? And because when you enjoy and when you are relaxed and you're at ease, and the same thing with the suttas, when you're relaxed and at ease, that is when you can take things on board. So important to enjoy these things. So this is where it all starts. And why is this so important? Why is it so incredibly fundamental? And the reason is, again, coming back to this idea of non-self, this very profound Buddhist idea, that there's nothing inherently stable in human beings, or anyone else, any animals or whatever beings for that matter. Because there's nothing stable inside of us. I'm just telling you how things look from a Buddhist point of view. You can investigate this for yourself. But because of that, it means that we are the product of the forces and conditions and the environment and the circumstances that work on us. Right? If there's nothing inherently stable in you, it means you are a product of all these things that work on you. In this life, maybe in past lives or whatever it is. So the simile that I always use, and I teach this every time I teach a retreat, is a simile of, imagine yourself that you are a ship on the ocean. But you are a ship which has no engine, has no rudder, has no sails, has no oars. All you have is the hull, right? Just the hull. And you're sitting in the ship. And because there is no steering mechanism, you are absolutely at the mercy of the conditions around you. The wind comes from the north, you go to the south. The wind comes from the west, you go to the east. If the current comes from the west, again, you go to the east. You are completely at the mercy of the conditions around you. And human beings, we are like that, right? We are also at the mercy of the conditions around you. So right now, you are at the mercy of me, my mercy. I'm conditioning you, right? Are you scared? I don't think you have to be too scared. And I'll talk about this a little bit afterwards, conditioning also, how we condition things in Buddhism. But we are at the mercy of things. And because we drift around like that, it is so important that we ensure we get the right kind of wind, we get the right kind of current, because then we will go in the direction we want to go. If you are in the middle of the Indian Ocean, right, sometimes you hear about these crazy sailors that sail around the world or whatever, they end up somewhere in the South Ocean somewhere. And if you want to get to Perth, well, you have to hope for an easterly wind, right, which pushes you towards the east. And if you come get that easterly wind, you come to Perth and okay, you're safe, you're fine, you don't end up in Antarctica or whatever. And this is exactly what we are trying to do in Buddhism. Get that right wind, right? Get the right currents. So we get pushed in the right direction towards more happiness, towards less suffering in life. And that wind, that current that we're trying to get hold of, is precisely the Buddha's teachings. Once you get influenced by the truth, once you get influenced by the by in a proper way of looking at the world, a way that takes you towards well-being and happiness, then you will tend to drift that way. First of all, because you recognize the truth in those things, and secondly, because those teachings have inherent power to take you in that direction. So important, right, to actually get that right. If you don't, you are like a blind person. Don't know what you're doing. Don't know where you're going. You have no idea what's happening. We've all been searching for happiness in the world. And very, very often, when you look around the world, people suffer, right? There's so much suffering in the world. So many problems going on. And here, finally, is a path that has the potential to take you in the right direction. Get hold of that path. Read those suttas. Understand the word of the Buddha. Try it every time you feel a little bit down. You feel you're losing contact with his teachings. Come to Dhammaloka. Hear Ajahn Brahm tell a few jokes, right? But remember that between the jokes, there's some very beautiful Dhamma teachings. They come together. And then this will lift you up, enable you to carry on this path. The source is seeing, hearing these noble teachings from the noble beings. And that will then, next step then, is that you will listen to those teachings from these people. Two things happening at the same time. You see the noble people, and when you see them, you get inspired just by the sight of such people, and you get to hear the powerful teachings at the same time. Very, very powerful combination. And then you get urged in the right direction, moved in the right direction. And when that happens, what happens then is that you start to get confidence and faith, right? You think, wow, this is actually very beautiful. Wow, it works. I put this into practice, they give results. This is why I am still a monk after 21 years or whatever it is. Perhaps some of you think you must be, sometimes people think you're nuts to be a monk for 20 years. What's the point? It's crazy. You're kind of giving up so much in the world. This is why I'm a monk after 20 years, because it is a gradual inclination in the right direction, a gradual moving into becoming more light, more easy life, more happy, cutting off the burdens right in life and soaring up. That is what these teachings are about. It's so powerful. And when you see that happening in your own life, combined with reading these powerful teachings, boy, the faith and the confidence starts to arise. Faith and confidence in Buddhism is two things. It is the intellectual confidence. This really makes sense. It all fits together very beautifully. It's like a large jigsaw puzzle, all the pieces fitting nicely together, not in a bad way, in a very beautiful way. But faith and confidence in Buddhism is also an emotional state. It's a state that when you bow down to the Buddha, you feel that you're bowing down to something very, very beautiful and very powerful. And sometimes, if you have the right attitude, it brings tears to your eyes because it's so powerful. Right? The more spiritually developed you are, the more easy it is to become tearful just by bowing down to the Buddha or by having a profound meditation experience. It's one of those fascinating things. When you read the suttas, one of the things that the Buddha says in the suttas is that in his teachings, those people in the world who have nothing to respect, nothing to revere, nothing to defer to, they live in suffering. Right? It's powerful. It gives you happiness to have something in life that you can respect, that you can look up to, that you can aspire for, right? This gives life meaning. It gives you a feeling of, yes, there is a purpose in all this. It makes you more happy. The Buddha said that. And then the Buddha says, right here is, from a Buddhist point of view, the world's number one spiritual master, the greatest spiritual genius that has existed, at least in known history, as far as Buddhists are concerned anyway. Right? He has attained the highest happiness. Let go of all suffering. He has nothing more to be done. And what does he say? He says that, well, what should I respect? What should I revere? Right? Because if you don't have anything to revere, you live in suffering. This is what the Buddha says. I find it so astonishing when I read that. I find it almost hard to wrap my mind around that. How can the Buddha say such a thing? And it shows you how important it is to have something in life that we can look up to and aspire for. And what the Buddha says is that, well, there is no being that I know or can see that is more attained or has a higher degree of awakening than me. And because there is no such being, there is no person I can respect or revere in that way. But what I can respect and revere in that way is this Dhamma, this discovery I have made, this truth that I have found, that I can respect and revere in this way. Even the Buddha says that, right? He is essentially setting an example for all of us that this is something very useful and very powerful to have something in life in this way here. So don't be afraid of faith. Don't be afraid of emotions. These are incredibly useful on the spiritual path. If you sit down and you meditate and you can wrap your head around who the Buddha actually was, sometimes it can give rise to very powerful joy in the mind. You have this teacher who has understood everything there is to understand about happiness and suffering and the path to get there. Right? He has given you the gift, essentially, putting it in your hands, saying to you, if you do this, you will be able to attain the highest happiness that is available in the world. Isn't that a powerful, it's the highest gift that anybody can give you. And he has given you that gift. It is so, you know, it is such a, of course, to be able to grasp all that, you have to grasp the teachings. And it's a kind of a slow, not necessarily very slow, but it is a process to get there. And as you keep going, it becomes more and more powerful as you move on into the future. So remember, there is such a thing as faith and confidence, also in Buddhism, but perhaps slightly different from what you find in certain other religions, perhaps. But anyway, it's there. What happens next? Well, once you get faith and confidence in that Buddhist teachings, what happens next is that you start to think differently. Why? Because you start to take on board the word of the Buddha. If the Buddha says this, and you have faith and confidence in what he's teaching, of course you start to apply yourself accordingly. If the Buddha says, this is how you overcome anger, you check it out. You try to overcome that anger. I think this is one of those often far too neglected teachings of Buddhism, are these basic teachings on how to use your mind to overcome these bad defilements like anger. And if I get a chance, I may talk about this in the near future here, right here, because it is such powerful and beautiful teachings. So you start to use your mind differently. You look at the world differently here. You start to prioritize things differently in life. Right? What is really important in life? This suddenly starts to change. Right? Other things start to take priority. It's not so much what you do, it's more about how you live that becomes important. The what is kind of secondary. And then everything changes as a consequence. Right? Your mind is changing. You're thinking differently. What is going on? You're getting brainwashed, right? That's what's going on. You're thinking differently. Brainwashing is happening. Remember, this is a beautiful thing when you get brainwashed in the right way. Right? This is very nice. It's like if you want to wash something in a nice way, you've got to get the right washing powder, a nice washing machine, right? And you wash it all, and then comes out on the other side, it's nice and clean. And this is the same thing with the Buddhist idea. Remember, when we use a word like brainwashing, it means that we get brainwashed anyway. We all get brainwashed, right? Every influence on us from the outside is a kind of brainwashing. If you are the product of the circumstances and the situations around you, it means that right now you are brainwashed. So make sure you get the good kind of brainwashing. Don't get the bad one. This is what coming here to Dhammaloka is all about, getting the good brainwashing. And that was what I was saying to you before about, are you feeling kind of scared sitting there? Because now, kind of, maybe this is like brainwashing, right? Are you worried about that? I remember when I first became a monk, my parents said, oh, now you're going to get brainwashed, right? We're going to kind of lose sight of you and never see you again because you're going to get brainwashed and become a Buddhist monk. My parents didn't know anything about Buddhism. They thought it was some kind of crazy cult or something. And you kind of end up committing suicide like some of these cults. I don't think they actually believe that, but they thought that maybe something in that direction. You have to exaggerate a bit for effect, right? But the point is that everything in life is really brainwashing. So what we have to do is try to choose that brainwashing which actually works. Ask yourself what works. Ask yourself from your experience what actually goes on in the right way. And then allow that brainwashing to happen. It's good, right? It's good to be brainwashed if it leads to happiness. It's good to be brainwashed if it brings everybody forward. It's good to be brainwashed if the suffering goes down. The brainwashing that is no good is the one where it leads you astray, leads you down the garden path, and you end up suffering far more than it did before. That's the bad stuff. So brainwashing, yay, more brainwashing, please. Come with Dhammalokasana. And then, when you get brainwashed, you start thinking in the right way. From that comes then a powerful commitment to doing the right things in life, to ethics, to kindness, to doing all of those good things that we know are part of the Buddhist path. I've always been astonished when I travel around sometimes, and I travel and I see some of the great monks in the world, mostly monks, there aren't so many nuns around yet, and when you meet some of these monks and you ask them questions, right? I think I may have told the story here before when I, just 10 months ago or something, I went to Thailand and I met one of these great Thai meditation masters. And he's been here to Perth and he's a good friend of Ajahn Brahm as well. Whenever you go to see him, he always praises Ajahn Brahm to the skies, right? It's always quite nice when that happens. But anyway, I went to meet this Thai meditation master here. And when you meet him, he's like this tiny little man, right? And he sits there on his chair, very, very peaceful, always has a smile on his face, always a large crowd of people around him. He's like a magnet, right? He draws people to him. He doesn't say anything. He just sits there and smiles, and people just come to him. Right? Isn't that kind of cool? It's this feeling of somebody who's so powerful, don't need to say a word. You just automatically, you kind of get drawn towards them. You have no choice. Again, brainwashing, dukkha. You move forward. And you just sit down. He doesn't have to say anything because when you're there, you just feel so relaxed and at ease in his presence, right? I can breathe, right? Usually in life, we're kind of tense, a little bit nervous, might get told off, might not do our work well enough. Here is somebody who accepts you for who you are, 100%, no judgment whatsoever. For the first time in your life, you can really breathe easily here. So anyway, I went to see this monk, and I was breathing easily as well. And I was sitting there, and when I was sitting there, because I was a disciple of Ajahn Brahm, a student of Ajahn Brahm, he really looks after me, right? It's such an astonishing thing when you go to this great meditation master, and he kind of looks after you in a special way. It feels really almost unreal in a sense. But the strange thing about these kind of meditation masters, they are so simple. The way they speak is so down to earth, right? It almost gives you the feeling that when somebody is really awakened and really have the act together, they don't say anything fancy. It's almost like the simpler the language, the more awakened they are in a sense. Right? So when you hear a corny joke from Ajahn Brahm, wow, he must be really awakened perhaps. So very simple language. And I asked him this question because he gave me all this time. I felt really privileged, to be honest. I felt I didn't really know what to. It was quite remarkable. And I asked him very simply, how do you practice metta? Because he has so much metta. Metta means kindness, right? Friendliness, love, if you like. It's kind of streaming out of him. How do you practice metta? And he's told me, he said, what you have to do is that every time when you wake up in the morning, you have to ask yourself, what can I do for the world today? Right? Nothing about sitting down, oh, may all beings be happy and well, right? None of that. What can I do for the world today? That is what you should ask yourself. And this is not only him. I've heard other people saying the same thing. This is the essence of what kindness and metta and the Buddhist path is all about. Right? Coming down to these basic simple teachings. How can I be kind? How can I say kind things? How can I think kind thoughts? Moment upon moment upon moment, day upon day upon day, week in, week out, year after year, sometimes lifetime after lifetime. How can I keep this at the back of my mind all the time so it's always there? This is one of those crucial aspects of the Buddha's teachings. Because if you can do this, what you are doing is you are changing your attitude to the people around you. Because if you have to be kind all the time, it means that whenever you don't feel like being kind, you have to start thinking differently. Your attitude changes. The way you look at people, look at the world becomes different. You're forcing yourself into a new track. Not forcing, because that's too harsh. You are You are encouraged to use your wisdom to find solutions to the problems in life. That's what's going on. Right? So if you do this, and this is where the path really starts to take off, when you're able to do this consistently all the time, always remembering this is what life is all about, right? This is the essence of living the spiritual life, living every single moment with kindness, with compassion, with the right outlook, at the very least with neutrality. If the mind goes into a negative state, you should ask yourself straight away, how can I change this around? How can I move this around into a different way? And then it becomes extraordinarily powerful. And if you do this consistently all the time like this, you are changing your character very fast. You're building up all these good qualities, right? You start to feel really good about yourself because you know inside, deep inside of yourself, that you are a good person. You're doing the right things. You don't really feel any. You don't feel badness about yourself anymore. If somebody else tells you off or says you're bad or whatever, you just shrug your shoulders. It's their problem. Nothing to do with me. They can think whatever they like. Right? People are always going to think what they like anyway. Can't do anything about that. It's their problem. I know I'm doing the right thing. It's no issue anymore. And then when you sit down, right? Then when you come to meditation, you're no longer forcing it. You're sitting down. Your mind is becoming peaceful. No thoughts are going on. Or you start to feel happiness and gladness inside. It becomes more and more powerful. The body calms down and becomes so beautiful and so peaceful and so still. Right? And then eventually you enter this powerful state of samadhi. Actually what you're doing, you're starting to experience, to find the answer to the very meaning of life itself. This is what you find in these deep states of samadhi. You can even take it beyond that into insight. But actually already at that point, you're finding the answer to the very meaning of life. Right? And it all comes from that practice of ethics at the basis of the path. And it all leads you in that direction. So if you want to find the answer to the meaning of life, if you want to find the highest happiness, the commitment, the perseverance that is required to get there, it comes basically from the discourses, from the teachings of the Buddha. That is the foundation work. Hang out with the Buddha. Hang out with powerful teachers like Ajahn Brahm, right? Or anyone else who is very powerful and has that ability to convey the Dhamma in the right way. And there are a few people out there like that. And as you hang out with that, and you start to understand what is going on, there's a very beautiful way that the Buddha has a simile about this. And the simile is that it's like the rain falling on the mountaintop, right? And as the rain falls on the mountaintop, as it rains and rains and rains, it merges together into little streams. And those streams merge together into larger streams. They go into the lakes. And then those lakes go into the rivers, right? And eventually the rivers go into the ocean. The more it rains on that mountaintop, the more powerful, the larger those rivers are. And eventually it all goes to the sea, which is the similarly here for the awakening experience itself. So all you have to do is keep it raining, right? Keep raining, keep raining, keep raining. Come back to the Dhamma. Contemplate these teachings. Understand what they're all about. Understand what it is that you have to do. Whenever you feel a little bit down, you don't feel that you have that initiative anymore. You don't have the inspiration anymore. Come back here. Listen to some good teaching. Take out the suttas. Try to understand what they're about. Lift yourself up. Contemplate these things. Rain, rain, rain. Larger and larger streams, eventually building up to the rivers, right? Eventually going to the ocean. As long as you keep it raining, you will eventually reach that goal. And that is what the Buddha had to say about commitment and perseverance on the Buddhist path. Okay, that is enough for this evening. Thank you very much. Okay, that's great. Thank you so much. Okay, so are there any questions, please, from the audience tonight? Anybody want to ask something here?
Over here. My
Oops.
Yeah. My question is, to try to access the sutras as a layperson, do you have like a recommendation of one that's a bit easy to read?
Sure, yeah. I do indeed. There are a number of things you can do. One of the things you can do is a book called In the Buddha's Words, which is an anthology of suttas, which is nicely they're nicely put together according to themes, and they have nice introductions and footnotes at the end explaining the suttas. Translation by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi. He's the number one translator of Buddha suttas. So In the Buddha's Words is a very good place to start. Or you can come on my sutta retreat, right? That is a really good introduction to the suttas, if you wish. If you are really committed, that is, you can do that. Also, sometimes it is also very nice just to start reading something like the middle-length sayings of the Buddha. Very nice suttas in there, quite long, and they have nice context to get a feeling for the Buddha was and all these kind of things. Also a very beautiful way of starting to read the suttas. You can also, we do all kinds of sutta readings here at Dhammaloka as well. Every Sunday we have a sutta reading here. Not every Sunday, every other Sunday. So you can come here or download it on the internet and you can listen to the explanation of the suttas. It can be very useful. In the beginning it may seem a bit difficult to get into them, but once you kind of get a feel for how they work, they become very useful. So a few ideas for you here. We should do more weekend sutta retreats. I really want to do more weekend sutta retreats. That's kind of my aim. But we only have so many retreats per year, you know. It's just part of the problem. But we'll see what we can do in the future. Anyone else want to ask anything? Everybody else so happy. Oh, okay. That's great. No questions. All this peace and stillness. Okay. Okay. Oh, over there. Okay. Okay, well, yes, the sutta I actually tonight's talk was based on is in the Anguttara Nikaya 10s, number 61, or 60 and 61, Anguttara 10s. So if you want to read it, but it's, you know, I've added just a little bit, you know, so just to kind of flesh it out a bit. That's basically where it comes from. Okay. Okay, so let's see what they have from overseas. I'm going to have to take out my glasses these days, so I just. It's always nice to be reminded that you're getting older, so you don't actually lose that kind of groundedness. Okay, so question number one. Nobody else have a question here? Okay, so we go to overseas. Question number one. This is from Surab Singh. How do we know our purpose in life and consequently commit to it? Could one's life's purpose change? How do you know your purpose in life? Okay, well, it's not that hard, actually, but you have to know where to look in the first place, right? Life has a very clear meaning, and all you have to do is to look inside of yourself to see what that meaning is. And what you see, when you look inside of yourself, is you see all these desires, all these cravings, all these things that we want to do, right? Now, ask yourself, when you have a desire, when you have a craving, what does that desire say to you? It says, when I get into this relationship, whoa, that will be it, right? This person is a perfect fit for me, and I will be happy ever after. That is essentially what craving and desire says. They say you will be satisfied. They say you will be content. They say the itch, which is the craving, will be abandoned once you get the desire fulfilled. But if you are wise, and if you really look at yourself, you start to realize, no, it doesn't actually happen that way. Yes, you pursue that craving, you pursue the object of the desire, and it doesn't actually get you there. There's more desires afterwards. Desire is a liar. Craving lies to you, doesn't tell you the truth. There's another way to finding this happiness that craving and desire promises you, and that is the spiritual path. Kindness, compassion, understanding other people. Right? This is the way to go if you want to find real contentment inside of you. That happiness you get from that is an immediate happiness in the present moment. Nothing to do with the future, nothing to do with craving, nothing to do with desire. And you realize, once you start to tap into that happiness, you realize, I have found the very thing that I was been looking for all the time. That craving was promising me all the time. Now I have found it. But I found it through different means than what I thought I should be used to get there. Right? So the meaning of life, the purpose of life is not very hard to understand. We tend to look in the wrong place. Look in the right place. Contemplate what will actually get you there. And then you're on the right track. Can that purpose change? No, that purpose can never really change. We all want to be happy. Right? Nobody wants, please give me more depression and sadness. Nobody says that, right? Everybody wants more ease, relaxation, contentment in life. Okay. Next one. This is from Ajay Mane from India. I apologize if I'm not pronouncing your name properly, but anyway, it is very important to know the reason behind it, behind the commitment question mark. What reason should I give to my mind to help me commit to the Buddhist practice? Because you will be happy, you will reduce suffering, you will reach the purpose of life, the meaning of life. This is what it's all about, right? If you commit to something which is the truth, which is reality, which is guides you towards happiness, guides you away from suffering, wow, so powerful. This is what I mean by reading the suttas. Once you get that message, you have to commit yourself, right? You have no choice anymore. Your mind will drag you along into that commitment because you understand that you have found the very purpose of life itself. Yeah. So this is kind of the whole point here, by studying a little bit the suttas, understanding these teachings, that they actually, once you get your mind around these things, whoa, it is so powerful and so beautiful. Number three, this is from Chiv in Sydney. When given several options, how do we know which action or path in life to commit to? Okay, when given several options, what should we do? How do we make choices in life? And the Buddha, as always, I always go back to the suttas. The Buddha gives some beautiful advice on how to make right choices in life. Right? So the first thing about making choices, never make a choice if your mind is clouded. If you are angry or upset about something, don't do anything. Just chill, just relax, right? Wait for the anger to pass. Certainly don't make any choices based on anger. If you have strong desires for something, don't make any choices based on strong desires. If you feel deluded or confused, not the right time to make decisions. The right time to make decisions is when you are really relaxed. You're at ease. Your mind is clear. There's no defilements there. There's none of these things which distort the mind one way or the other, right? That is the right time to make a decision. Because then you will have clarity. We often talk about intuition in life, right? Intuition is actually a very powerful tool to use to make decisions. But you have to know when intuition is right. And intuition is only right when the mind is clear and not clouded. When there's no desires there, when there's no anger, that is when intuition is correct and you can trust that intuition. This is very useful advice. If you follow that, you're going to start making some really, really good decisions in life. Only make decisions when your mind is clear. Sometimes it's blooming obvious what you have to do, right? If the mind is clear, of course I have to do this. I was just deluded before. Suddenly everything becomes very clear to you. This is number one. The second grounds for making decisions in life is remember that if you really are committed to spiritual practice, and by that I just mean kindness basically, if you really are committed to being kind, compassionate, understanding, thinking in the right way, if that is what matters in your life, and I tell you straight away, please make that the most important thing in life, because everything else really is completely secondary. Who cares if you have a nice house, big house? Who cares if you climb to the top of the corporate ladder, right? It's all borrowed stuff. You're going to have to give it up when you die anyway. The only thing you take with you beyond death is the goodness of your heart and the kindness that you have accumulated over a long life. That is what matters. That is where you should invest your time and your resources, not in all the worldly things. It is so obvious when you start thinking about it. So therefore, what that consequence of that is that whenever you make a choice, you should ask yourself, what is going to help me on in my practice of kindness, in my practice of generosity, in my practice of meditation, in my spiritual path? What is the right choice to make me move forward on that path in the best way? So if you're going to find a place to live, right? What is a good place to live that is helpful for for a spiritual practice. Maybe somewhere a little bit peaceful. Maybe somewhere not too far away from a Buddhist center. Somewhere where you have good kalyanamittas, right? Good friends who can support you. This kind of stuff, right? What is the right kind of job to have? Maybe a job that is not too stressful. Maybe a job where you have at least a few like-minded friends, right, to work with you. These are the kind of things you take into account. And that, again, I think, is the best way to make a decision. Of course, this is only true if you are really committed again, right? Commitment, again, is the essential thing here. But if you really are committed to this path, to this practice, that is what you should be doing here. Okay, that is all for tonight. So let us pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Sūpatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sangho